All right, so that's Sidney, New York. It's a little town where I grew up, population about 5,000. It's an upstate New York sandwich between Oneonta and Binghamton. If those two cities mean anything to you, they might not. But that's where I grew up, and this is the church I went to. It's called Circle Drive Alliance Church. That's actually where my parents are today, even as we're meeting here. They still go there, and that's where I spent my formative years from about age 5 to really through college I went there. And that's where I got my first start in ministry. My first job, my entry-level job into ministry, was doing puppets at VBS when I was in 7th grade. For the littlest group, I did puppets. And I guess I did a good job because I got promotion, and I got moved up to doing the skits for everybody the next year with my brother, which was an awesome experience working with my brother. We had a lot of fun with that. And I kept moving on up the ladder, I guess, because it was a small church and there was no one else to move up those ladders. So we had these youth-led services where the youth would put on the service. And we would usually play recorded music because none of us had any musical ability whatsoever. So we would play like a CD and sing along, and the congregation would be very nice and generous to us because we were trying. And then they had someone speak, and so, I don't know, they asked me to speak. I memorized Bible verses, so I guess I thought I was a good Christian. So they had me speak at some of those services, and that was the first chance I really ever had to do ministry, and it started to cement this potential path for my life that I could be in full-time ministry. You know, when you grow up in a small church, if you do memorize your Bible verses, and you're a pretty good kid overall, people are going to tell you you should probably be in full-time ministry when you're in one of those like small country churches, which this one was. And so that's where I got my start. And actually, my pastor, when I was in 8th grade, he was just a 30-year-old man. He had just come to our church. It was his first church. He was a very energetic guy. He would call my brother and me up on snow days, and he would ask my mom, can Mark and Steve come out and play? And he would take us and play basketball in town, even though the roads were terrible. And we lived out in the country, so this was a significant commitment for him to do. But I guess, you know, after seeing, he saw some potential in me, and so he wanted to encourage me. And so he said, Steve, after my junior year, would you like, in college that is, would you like to do an internship this summer and we'd lead the youth group? And I said, sure, because at that point I'd been delivering ice cream for my summer job, which sounds a lot more fun than it actually is. It's actually a lot of work. It wasn't fun at all, but so I decided, yeah, this is a good opportunity. And so I took the job, and that really became the confirmation that this was something that I wanted to do with my life, that I wanted to go into ministry on a full-time basis. So really, this church did so much for me. It's where I really started ministry and has a lot to do with where I am today. And last year, they were between pastors, so I told my mom, I'd love, you know, for the chance to go up there and speak, you know, just for a week or so if they ever needed somebody. And so my mom said, sure, yeah, I'll tell them. And she's like, well, they'll call you. And they never did, so maybe they remembered those sermons when I was in high school and decided they didn't want me back. But eventually they finally called me and said, can you come up and speak? And it was one of those heavy moments in life because for me it was like going full circle, coming to this place where I had been and I could look out on the congregation. And even though so much had changed since when I first preached in high school with the congregation, I could look out and see my junior high Sunday school teacher and some of my nursery teachers and just so many different people who had played little roles in my life. You know, it wasn't like any of them ever had this like huge mentoring role for me, but all of them had these little contributions for me and it made me who I was. So it was a great moment, a really gratifying moment to go back there and to be able to go home and go full circle. Well, I tell you that story because the passage that we're looking at this week is a moment where Jesus gets to go home for the first time. This is a chance for him. It's the first time since he entered the public fray, had gone into ministry, that he went back to his hometown. Okay, so you can find this passage in Luke chapter 4. Unfortunately for Jesus, well, actually more unfortunately for the people of Nazareth, his hometown, things didn't go as well there as they did for me when I got to go home. So we're going to look at this passage, understand what went wrong on this particular speaking occasion. And it wasn't something wrong with Jesus, of course. It was something wrong with his audience. But we're going to take a look. By the way, that's Nazareth today. It's still a city that exists, a big city in Israel. Not the biggest. It's actually one of the few major cities in Israel that is mostly non-Jewish. It's actually mostly Arabic, a strong Christian contingent. As you can imagine, Nazareth has been an important place historically for the church as far as pilgrimages go. So that's what it looks like today. But in Jesus' day, it's this really small town. That's actually a house that was excavated in Nazareth, a very simple, small little house. You can see its walls and where it was. Really only one level, maybe a little basement type thing for storing places. Nazareth is a town of about 300, maybe 500 people in Jesus' day. A lot of clans, a lot of people sort of like, you know, connected by family somewhere, you know, cousins down the road somewhere. Everybody stopped counting, though, you know, what cousins they were. But that was the kind of town Nazareth was, and that's where Jesus grew up. And so when Jesus came back, that's where he went. Now, Jesus had been ministering in a lot of different places. He'd been in Capernaum, which is up there. This is Israel back in Jesus' day. That's the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus does a lot of his ministry. So he starts off, he does a lot of ministry in Capernaum. And, you know, in Cana, he did his first miracle of changing the water into wine. Nazareth is all the way down there, okay? So it's a very small town. In fact, really the only record we have of it from Jesus' day is the Bible, because nothing much happened there. So Jesus goes back, and he'd been doing some ministry, like in Capernaum and Cana, and the buzz was growing about Jesus, because he had been doing some amazing things. All right, he'd been performing miracles. I don't think he's been in ministry real long, but it didn't take long to notice that Jesus was spectacular and amazing. All I had to do is see one of these little healing services that he put on, and you could see the lame walk and the blind see, and Jesus do all kinds of different things, okay? So Jesus, the buzz about Jesus was growing. And so when he came back to Nazareth, people were excited, and they were expectant that he was going to do something amazing. And I think they had really high expectations for what he was going to do. Although, as we'll see, maybe there's a little bit of skepticism in them as well. Remember, this is a guy they grew up with. And so for the first 30 years of his life, he probably didn't do anything miraculous. We have no record of him doing anything until after he's baptized by John, when he's around 30 years of age. Before that, we have only a couple stories of when he was an infant, of course, the birth narratives, and one story when he's about 12 and goes to the temple, where he shows some precocious knowledge, but really didn't show anything miraculous, okay? So the people of Nazareth are waiting, and so it's a Sabbath, it's in the synagogue where the Jews worshiped, and you know, they had a service where they had liturgy in the beginning where people prayed. They had some prayers that they went through, some creeds they recited, and then they had the reading. So Jesus gets up, and maybe as a visiting dignitary, sort of, so to speak, he's asked to read. So he opens one of these scrolls, okay, and he flips through it, and he finds this one spot in Isaiah. He's the scroll of Isaiah he's handed. And if you read Isaiah during the Eat This Book series, you know Isaiah is immense. It's a long book. It's one of the longer books in the Bible. And so he scrolls through it to this one very specific place. All right, so let's read what happens and what he says when he's there. So you can start in verse 14. Jesus of chapter 4. Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread through the whole countryside. He taught in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. He went back to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue, as was his custom, and he stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." All right, so let's consider for a moment, why does Jesus choose this passage? I think he has two major reasons. The first, it helps identify who he is. So by reading this passage, and then by saying very boldly, "This has been fulfilled in your midst," he is telling the people of Nazareth who he is, and he's doing so in a biblical fashion. He's defining himself through Scripture. Okay, now this is Isaiah 61 as a passage that describes the work of the Messiah and the future salvation that God's going to bring to his people. This good news that's going to be brought to the poor, the captives being released, all of those things coincided with the Messiah coming and delivering Israel from its current state and restoring it beyond any past glory it had ever had, making Israel a bigger and better and more powerful kingdom than it had ever been before in its history. Okay? Now, it's important to realize that when God tells about his salvation, when God says about anything that he's going to do within human history, he always accomplishes his purposes through people. So even the days of Moses, when Moses leads the people out of Egypt, you know, God does all these tremendous plagues, parts the Red Sea, but he chooses a person to go and be his spokesman. And this is his MO. This is how God operates. Whenever he does something, he sends a prophet, he raises up a king. In the days when in the early days of Israel, when it would be overrun by foreign enemies, God would raise up judges and they would come and lead the people to freedom. And so God would always raise up somebody. This is how God works. He likes to use people. He doesn't have to. You know, it's not like God needs somebody to do these things. It's not like Moses made the plagues happen or had like 40% of the work in it or even 25% or even 10%. No, it was all God, but God chose to use Moses. And likewise, God was going to use this figure, the Messiah, the anointed one, to bring this future salvation that the Israelites were expecting. It was going to be done through a person. All right, now you can kind of connect the dots in Isaiah, and there's some messianic passages that sort of treat the Messiah like he's more than just a person. Like he actually might be God. He might be divine. Now, obviously, not all Jews believe that. There are many Jews who didn't think the Messiah would be divine at all. But especially after you have Jesus, it's easy to look back and connect the dots. Well, Jesus is not here claiming to be the Son of God, per se. But he is telling them, I am your Messiah. Now, notice he doesn't do it directly. He doesn't come out and just say that to his audience. Instead, he does it a little bit more subtly, a little bit more indirectly. This is how Jesus likes to operate as well. He likes people to sort of connect the dots and take the next step in their mind. So he sets it up and says, look, all of these things that you've associated with the coming of the Messiah, this salvation that you're going to receive, this has been fulfilled in your midst. That's a very bold thing to say, isn't it? So what you just read, that's going to happen right here in front of you today. You're seeing the person who is anointed with the Spirit of God. He's here. I am him. Now that's what he's saying to the people, and I think if the people are listening, they're going to understand that. Now they might turn to each other and say, did he really say that? Is that really who he's saying he is? Because that's a bold thing to say. So they might have had some discussion about this, and as you know, as Jesus goes through his ministry, there's a lot of controversy about him. And that's why people will come and press him. Are you the Messiah? Are you the one we were to expect? And even for people like John the Baptist, who at some point in his ministry comes to apparently possibly doubt that Jesus was the Messiah or have some questions about it, and he comes and he sends his disciples to ask Jesus, are you the Messiah? Jesus doesn't just say, yeah, I am. He points to what he's doing. Okay? Hey, the blind are receiving their sight. The lame are walking. What is that? Who does that mean that I am? And so even with John, he asked him to make a conclusion. This is how Jesus likes to operate. Okay, so to the people of Nazareth who have known him, remember, they've known him his whole life probably. They've seen him grow up in their midst. And he is telling them, I'm the Messiah. Now this is a bigger deal than even if you went to class, you went to school when you were in elementary school with the future president of the United States. This is an even bigger deal than that, obviously. And the fact that Jesus, his ascent is so apparently drastic, it really had to jar the people. And they really had to wonder about this and say, can we believe him? Can we actually buy that he's the Messiah? And you'll see what their response is in a little bit. Now, the second reason Jesus chooses this passage is not just to identify who he is, it's to identify his mission. He is telling his audience in Nazareth, this is what I'm going to do. All right, so let's look at that a little bit. So he lists, proclaim good news to the poor, proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recover your sight for the blind, set the oppressed free, proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Now, as Jesus' audience would have understood these things, they really all applied to Israel. Because, see, I think that the people in Jesus' day, they had a bias. They sort of had blinders on as they heard this. They didn't hear all of what God wanted to do when they read this passage. Because they would have applied this mostly to Israel. Really all to Israel. So who was the poor? Is the people of Israel. Because they have been oppressed by foreign powers. Remember, Israel doesn't rule themselves. They're ruled by the Romans. And they've been ruled by Gentiles, by other people, for many years. Okay? Assyrians run through about 722 BC, take half the nation captive. Then you have the Babylonians rolling after the Assyrians. They take them over, destroy the temple. Then you have the Persians come in. Persians are a little bit nicer than the Babylonians. They let them rebuild the temple. The Greeks come in. They desecrate the temple. All right, so things just keep going and going and going and getting rebuilt, destroyed. And then finally, the Romans ascend to power after a brief time when the Jews were independent under the Maccabees. But they've had to live by other people's rules. It's not like the Romans were awful, per se, to live under. But when you have a pagan empire who's ruling over you, and you're monotheist, you only worship one God, you don't worship idols, this can lead to a lot of tension. And so Israel really had to fight to maintain some sort of like spiritual independence. And so if you ask an Israelite, most of their problems were caused by Gentile people. Okay? So that's their main problem in their mind. And so these promises are there to set them free from their oppressors. See, they're the captives. They're going to be set free. Okay? So they interpret this almost completely in physical and historical terms, that God's going to set his kingdom under the rulership of the Messiah on earth in a substantial way, and all other nations are going to come in and bring tribute and basically bow down to the authority of the Jewish people. That was their hope. Okay? Now, we also have sort of a bias when we read this too, because we would interpret Jesus' words almost purely in spiritual terms. Okay? Now, if I asked you, what's the primary benefits of the salvation that comes through Jesus Christ, probably the first two things that would rattle off your tongue, maybe not for all of you, but would be eternal life and forgiveness of sins, right? So when we look at those words, we would maybe think the poor of spirit, like Jesus said in Matthew 5, people who are humble, understand that they need God, proclaim freedom for the prisoners, and those oppressed, maybe they're oppressed by sin and death, they need freedom from that. Recover your sight for the blind. Well, there's a spiritual blindness that we need to be cured of because we can't see God or us as we truly are, and we need God's light so we can actually see things for how they are. And to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Now, just a quick word on that. Year doesn't mean calendar year here. It means sort of age or era. So this is just like the dawning of God's empire, God's kingdom, where people consistently are now going to experience God's favor and his blessings in a very real and dramatic sense, okay? So we will look at that as the Lord's favor, probably as more of a, you know, we have salvation through Jesus Christ available to us. So I think we would look at this mainly in spiritual terms. So we wouldn't look at the historical or physical fulfillment of these quite so much. Although we might say, well, Jesus did, you know, heal blind people. And he did set some people who are, you know, cast out demons from people who were oppressed by demons. So Jesus clearly does some of this stuff as well. But we would probably focus more on the spiritual side of it. Okay? But that's what Jesus is saying. This is my mission. These are the things that I'm going to be about while I'm on earth. And then he makes that bold statement, this has been fulfilled in your midst today. Now you could argue, how has this been fulfilled? He just read a passage to them. All he did is get up there in front of them and read. Really? That was enough to fulfill all of these things? Well, if you notice, there's a lot of focus here on proclamation, on preaching. And so Jesus is saying, you know, the one who has the Spirit is here right now. You're hearing the good news. You're hearing about freedom and release to the captives right now. I'm here. I'm fulfilling this. It's happening in your midst. So I think, in a way, that's what Jesus is saying. But in another sense, I think Jesus understands as he goes through his ministry, I mean, he starts the ball rolling. But even when Jesus leaves the earth, physically speaking, he leaves his church behind. He leaves his followers behind to continue with that mission. And so Jesus probably, maybe in, you know, I can't prove that he's thinking this way, but I wonder if he's thinking about fulfillment, not just because based on what he will do, but based on the fact that his ministry, his death, his resurrection, his ascension, his giving of the Spirit is going to create a people who are going to be present in the world, continuing on, who will bear witness to who he was and will be his hands and feet in the world. And so I think that he's hinting, implying that he has these people who's going to come behind him and who are going to carry on this mission so that this will be fulfilled. And the fulfillment right here is starting in your midst. Maybe it just means in the sense that, okay, the one who here, who is going to be anointed by the Spirit, is present with you. But I think he means a little bit more than that. So how do the people respond? Well, this is where things get a little bit more interesting. It starts well. All people spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. Isn't this Jesus' son, they asked. And then Jesus replies to this. Jesus said to them, surely you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum. I tell you the truth, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years, and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. All right, when Jesus says this stuff, it seems like he's throwing gas on the fire, or he's picking a fight with them. Because up until this point, they're saying, wow, this guy's amazing, and all of a sudden Jesus is almost like, you know, being contentious with him. That's how it seems. But if you read the same story in Matthew and Mark, what you find is that in reality, his audience is offended by him. They're offended by Jesus. Well, why is that? It's hard to completely understand this. But remember, this is an ordinary guy who grew up in their midst. There probably didn't seem anything special about him. He's just another carpenter's boy. I don't know, maybe he did good woodwork. We don't know. Maybe he did average woodwork. Who knows? This guy is nothing special, though, in their eyes. And here he is. Where did he get this wisdom? Where did he get this power from? You know, he didn't get trained as a rabbi. He wasn't a learned man. Where did he get this from? And do you see how maybe they would be offended by that? It's hard to completely understand. The only way I can sort of conceptualize it through an example, this is not maybe the best example, but is an example. So suppose, you know, when I went to school, I played with a kid, you know, I played basketball. So one of the kids on my basketball team was just, you know, ordinary player, never really did much for our team, you know. And then all of a sudden, when he goes to college or maybe beyond college, he just enters the NBA and starts playing like LeBron James. Like, it would just be hard for me to understand, and maybe be a combination of jealousy and like, where were you before when we needed you? Where was this when I actually could have benefited my life? But maybe that's what's going on here, that because he's one of their own and he never showed anything special, they just can't process the fact that he has all these abilities now. You know, usually the hometown done good is a good story, right? But in this case, it's not. They're offended by him. In fact, Jesus hints at another dynamic that's happening. He says, surely you will quote this proverb, physician, heal yourself. Do you hear what you did in Capernaum? What he's saying there is because, as Mark and Matthew describe, Jesus didn't do many miracles in Nazareth, hardly any. Now, it almost seems controversial the way Mark says it, because he says basically because the people didn't believe Jesus couldn't do any miracles. Matthew smooths it out a little bit and said he only did a few miracles. Now, this isn't that Jesus needs, you know, faith to respond. You know, he doesn't need our faith to make him do miracles. But that's, again, that's the way God has chosen to minister to us. He wants people to believe in him. You know, he could have obviously performed these miracles. He doesn't require our faith. Our faith is not what makes Jesus who he is. Jesus is who he is. And it's just good sense on our part to put our faith in him. All right, but our faith doesn't make him better. You know, sort of like in, I think this is Tinkerbell. You know, the fairies need the kids to believe in them. You know, if the kids stop believing in the fairies stop being able to do so much. Look, I have a 5-year-old. You know, what do you expect from me? I know lots of the Tinkerbell and princess stories. But I'm pretty sure that was in there. Jesus is not like those fairies. He doesn't need the belief of others to make him something. He is what he is. He possesses this power inherently. And yet, because this audience, his hometown crowd, is sitting there grumbling about him, saying, oh, don't we know his brother and sister? We know them. We've seen them. Is his mother still here with us? Don't we know them? They're there grumbling. And Jesus is like, you know, I'm not going to heal you. It's an intentional reaction on Jesus' part. You want to believe in me? You want to put your trust in me? Humble yourself? Yeah, then I'll do some miracles. And you'll see what you saw in Capernaum or what you heard about. But until then, it's not happening. All right, so the people are turning against Jesus. And then Jesus, at this point, really does throw gas on the fire. Which, you know, we like to think of Jesus as, you know, a very calm person, you know, very zen-like, who, I don't know, just had a way about him that just, like, you know, very spiritual way that just really made people feel at ease. No, not really. Not always. He could really, especially when he saw unbelief, he pressed in against it and pushed against it. So he does that with this people, and he says, hey, you remember the times of Elijah and Elisha, these great prophets in your history? Well, remember who they actually did miracles for? Now, it's interesting that he points to Elijah and Elisha, because when you look, this is another misconception we have about the Bible, that it's just chock full of miracles from Genesis to Revelation. That's nothing but miracles. That's not really the case. So if you did eat this book, you went through lots of times in the Bible where nothing really supernatural happens, or not much. So if you actually charted the miracles on a graph, you could actually see that the miracles sort of they're kind of scattered at specific times. Maybe the time of Moses, you see lots of supernatural things happen. Times of Elijah and Elisha. Sometime during the kings, you'd see something happened that was kind of amazing. But for the most part, the miracles are kind of scattered around. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't miracles that weren't reported in the Bible. But as far as the Bibles that we, the miracles that we see in Scripture are kind of spaced out. All right? And so there aren't too many people that you can look to who did miracles on the level Jesus did. In fact, you would expect that he transcended everybody in that regard. But the only prophets that do anything sort of similar to what Jesus did were Elijah and Elisha. Okay, because they actually, both each one of them, raised somebody from the dead. Now, Elisha has a lot of sort of strange miracles attributed to him, like making an axe head float. Just things that are sort of like, you know, that's nice that he did that, but was that really necessary? Whereas Jesus' miracles all sort of seem in response to like dramatic human need. But anyway, but these two guys, Elijah and Elisha, are sort of a good sort of comparison for Jesus. The only person he can sort of point to and say, yeah, these guys are like me. And yet, who did Elijah go to? He went to a widow. God sent him to a widow. Not in Israel, in Zarephath. You know where Zarephath is? It's in New Jersey. Well, there is a Zarephath in New Jersey, but this is not the one. It's in Sidon, which is actually outside. And Tyre and Sidon was a kingdom, and they a lot of times become sort of emblematic of enemies of God's people or evil, if you look at the prophets. But Elijah goes to this widow who's not an Israelite, and you know she's kind of starving when he finds her, and he does this miracle, or a miracle is done through Elijah on her behalf, where she never runs out of oil. She keeps being able to make food for her and her son. Then her son dies, and Elijah actually raises him from the dead as he prays to God. But again, she wasn't Israelite. And then the guy who came to Naaman, who came to Elisha, he was Aramean. He was from Syria, basically. He was an army captain. So he's basically a potential enemy of the people. In fact, when the king of Israel sees Naaman coming to want to meet this prophet, he's scared. He thinks this is an omen of war. But he is healed of leprosy. And Jesus says, hey, there are lots of other widows in Elijah's time who lived in Israel. He didn't go to any of them. Lots of lepers, he didn't go to any of them either. What's Jesus saying? See, what he's saying scandalizes the people because he's making a few implications. First of all, the people of Israel were never so bad spiritually as they were in Elijah's time. That's the time of Ahab, if you remember him. He was like the worst king Israel ever had. I think it was kind of a race between him and his dad, Omri. It's like a neck and neck thing. Who was the worst king? They're both really exceptionally evil people. And they brought Israel to worship all these other gods. And so they're very, you know, this is a very terrible time in the spiritual history of Israel. And so basically by pointing to that time, Jesus is implying that you guys here today, you're really not any spiritually different from those guys. That was scandalous to them because the people in Jesus' day, say what you will about them, and you know we sort of look at some of them as hypocrites and all that kind of stuff now. But really in terms of Israel and their, you know, their main struggle with idolatry, this is actually a pretty decent time for the Jewish people. They aren't worshiping idols. In fact, they're identifying themselves against these pagan Roman, this pagan Roman Empire. Not all of them, but a lot of them are really going out of their way to avoid that kind of, you know, sin and worshiping idols. And so this is a time, you know, where Israel's doing pretty well, or so they think, and Jesus is saying, no, you're not. You're not. You're the same as those people were back then. And the other thing he's implying is that because of your response to God, he's going to bypass you. So all these benefits that you think are about you, because of your rejection of the one that he sent, you're not going to receive that. And it's going to go to the Gentile people. He doesn't say that directly, but that's the implication. How do I know that? Because this was what happens in the next verse. In 28, all the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him down the cliff. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. They try to kill him over what he said. That's how serious Jesus' words were. They get what he's saying, that you are no better off than the people of, you know, Ahab's time, and you're going to miss the salvation of God, and it's going to go to the Gentiles, which is almost blasphemy to them. They hate the Gentiles. The Gentiles have caused all their troubles. How could God show them kindness? They're supposed to come and pay tribute to us as the preeminent kingdom, and you're saying they're going to receive this? That's why they want to kill him. All right, so they get him up there, angry mob, they get him up to the hill. And then what happens next is a little bit of conjecture. It says Jesus just walked right through them, which is kind of a mysterious phrase, right? So you have two options here. One, he sort of teleported from their midst. You know, he did some sort of amazing Jesus miracle and just was here, and then he wasn't, okay? That's one possibility. The second possibility is, you know, it's an angry mob. Angry mobs usually aren't the smartest. So they're up there, like, really angry and chanting, and all of a sudden they realize, oh, where's Jesus go? We didn't bring Jesus? What? Are you kidding me? They have to go back all the way. They have to go back to town and find him. So that's another possibility. It's just in the heat of the moment, this angry mob loses the one they're trying to kill. It's probably happened before, actually. So whatever interpretation you want to take there, we really don't know 100%, but Jesus is not his time. All right? They want to kill him. This is not the only time that people try to kill Jesus. All right? This is only one of the, you know, they don't get to until the end when it's his time. Okay? But that's how Jesus' homecoming went. Didn't turn out so well, did it? All right? So what do we make of this? Well, first we need to reckon with who Jesus is. Now, most of us, you're here today because you believe Jesus is the Messiah. You believe he's the Son of God. You know, our church believes that. And so I'm assuming that either you've grown up with that or you've heard that while you're here and you're okay with that. You know, but there are a lot of people out there who believe that Jesus never claimed that he was the Messiah or claimed that he was the Son of God, that these were things that people put on his mouth later. You know, his followers 100, 200, you know, years later. And one of the more popular arguments is that in the time of Constantine, that they sort of stamped Jesus as this divine messianic figure, when all he really was a good Jewish rabbi. But Jesus claimed supernatural things about himself. And to understand him, you have to reckon with his words. And the fact that he does it a little bit more indirectly and subtly is actually, to me, better proof that these are his original words. You know, sometimes people will question, well, do you really have Jesus' words in your Gospels? They wonder, you know, how do we know that we can believe what's written there? I sort of have to believe that if later Christians came and wanted to present Jesus or have Jesus present himself as a Messiah, they would have put on stronger attestations that he was the Messiah. They would have put on his lips, yes, I am the Messiah. It would have been a recurring theme, but he does it more subtly, and that to me is better evidence that that's how he approached it, you know, because he wanted people to take that next step. That was how he worked, all right? And so today we have to understand and reckon with who Jesus is. So today, if you haven't done that for whatever reason, if you've held back on believing in him as your Messiah, as your deliverer, you need to reckon with that because there is no other salvation that's available to us. He is the one that God has chosen to bring that. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord was upon him to make it happen. And if you meet people along the way who might say something like, Jesus never claimed to be the Messiah or the Son of God, false. It's not right. He did. Okay? That's why people tried to kill him. Okay. Second thing we need to deal with is the mission of God. Now, I said that we both have, both Jesus listeners and us, we have our biases and how we hear this. Now, I think in our day, we interpret these words as a little bit more spiritual. And so we would walk away thinking our primary and maybe our only real responsibility in the world is to preach the gospel. Okay? Now, we have been given the commission to bear witness to Jesus, to proclaim who he is through our words. There's no question about it. But not all of this is about preaching, is it? To set the oppressed free. Well, what if we find people who are oppressed in our world? Will we do nothing to try to free them? Will we only preach good news to the poor? Will we not try to love them too? Will we not try to provide for their needs? I mean, James called that foolishness in his letter. He said, you know, when you meet someone who's poor, you want to say, God bless you, and then walk on your way. No, you say, God bless you, and then you give them clothes or food or whatever it is they need. You know, sometimes, this, you know, the church, we've set up this false dichotomy. When I say church, I mean sort of the American church or the church across the universal church. Some churches focus on preaching evangelism to the point where they don't really do acts of ministry. Other churches focus only on service and what we might call mercy ministry, caring for the poor and such. All right. But it's really this needless argument to have. Both of these things are things that we are called to do by Christ because Christ's mission was about doing both those things. So if we are his followers, how can't we do likewise? You know, why can't we do both things at once? But sometimes people argue about this. You know, it's been sort of almost a source of tension within some churches. All right? There's no reason you can't do both. Now, the generation that we're seeing growing up now, even though they're very narcissistic overall, no offense, guys, a little bit focused on themselves, you know, because of various technology and stuff. Not that, like, the rest of us aren't narcissistic at all, but, you know, so this generation is a little bit, you know, sort of self-absorbed, but they're also very aware of the needs that are out there. And I'm telling you, if this generation sees the Church of Jesus Christ doing very little to help the poor, to free slaves, to deal with some of these physical issues that are true in this world, that generation is going to turn the other way and walk away from the church because they don't think the church is really doing anything that's real. And you might argue with that and say that's not the way they should be, but I think that's generally true. They need to see the church not just preaching, proclaiming, but also living out in love the mission of Jesus Christ by caring for those in need. They need to see that. All right, and I would say it's not just them who need to see it, probably it's other people as well, you know, folks who've been around for a lot longer than them. All right, but there's no reason that we should ever do only one or the other. That the heart of God, the heart of Christ lies in the middle, doing both. There's no dichotomy here. You can do both of these. And sometimes, you know, churches argue about this for no reason because really they don't do either one well. They don't preach and they don't serve others either. And so let's be a church, whether as individuals in our lives, in our private lives, or just as a church overall in how we do ministry, let's do both of these things. Let's preach. Let's proclaim Jesus Christ by all means. No matter who gets upset at us, who decides that we're intolerant, or any other word they want to throw at us, let's proclaim Jesus Christ, but let's love the people who are in need. Let's care for the poor. Let's take care of those who are oppressed. Oh, you can't really see this graphic too well. It's called End It. It's the End It movement. And it's kind of an anti-slavery movement that's kind of grown out of some of the things that they do down in, I know there's this guy named Louis Giglio. He's a pastor. He was actually the one who was going to do, I think, the inaugural prayer this last January when Barack Obama was inducted. But then they said he couldn't because he had one point spoken out against homosexuality. But anyway, his church and some people in it have really focused on ending slavery because, you know, slavery is a real issue in this world. It didn't end in 1865, after all, but it still happens, even if it's not legal. It's happening probably within 50 miles of where we are today, that there are people held against their will. You know, I saw a newspaper article where even Toledo, Ohio, what happens to Toledo, Ohio? Apparently slavery. Apparently people are held against their will in places like Toledo, Ohio. You know, this is the problem everywhere, guys. Slavery is very real. And there are more people being trafficked, whether for sex or for any other thing, but it's more now than ever before in the history of the world. Now, if Jesus said that his mission was to set the captives free, how can we just say, oh, that's terrible, and do nothing about it? There are organizations out there, not just End It Now, but people who are trying to do something about it. There's this group called the International Justice Mission. I think it's IJM.org. Started by this guy named Gary Hagen. All right? And he was a lawyer. And this became a burden to him. He's like, you know, we can't put up with all these people who are held against their will. This seems very anti-Jesus to do this. Okay? We got to be like Christ. We got to do something about this. And so he got together law enforcement people. He got together lawyers. Because he realized you can't just throw money at this. You can't just go buy somebody out of slavery and know that they're going to be free. You have to actually fight the system. And you have to put people in jail sometimes, and you have to free people. And so they go and advocate in other nations and our own, to politicians, to have law enforcement. I mean, they're not like vigilantes out there running around, like, you know, with machine guns or whatever, but they're people who, through law enforcement and various other channels, work to set people free. So I think that's really cool. You know, because he started with thinking about who Jesus was and what his mission was, and now he done something about it. So that's amazing to me. And there's some other churches, if we go back, the churches that we served with in Argentina did both of these things tremendously well. Now, granted, in Argentina, there are a lot more immediate needs that you just see, that just pop off, you know, just you can just see them right in front of you. And here it's a little bit different. But they did a tremendous job in Argentina about proclaiming the gospel, yet working to actually improve people's lives, caring for the poor, taking care of families, building up families. There are some churches like that across the world, but there's also a church like Redeemer Presbyterian in New York City that does a tremendous job of reaching out to the city around them and saying, it's not just for us to preach, we need to love in a tangible way the city around us and to pour ourselves out like Jesus poured himself out. And the last, so we need to reckon with the mission of Jesus. You know, I always kind of laugh when churches, you know, have to like talk a lot about what the mission of the church is. Really? Do we need to make, you know, do we really need to investigate mission statements and all that kind of stuff? We know what the mission is. Now, yeah, some ways you come up with a mission statement and it comes a way people can remember and it kind of spurs them on. But Jesus has given us mission statements. He's given us our mission. There's no doubt about it, right? We know what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be making disciples. We're supposed to be loving our neighbors as ourselves. Jesus has set that before us. And he's saying, go and do it. And so many of us aren't, you know, as a church, as individuals, sometimes we aren't really reckoning with Jesus' mission for our lives. And we have to understand that, that Jesus' mission might take us into places that we're uncomfortable with, people that we're uncomfortable with, because, you know, the people in Jesus' day when Jesus was proclaiming what his mission was tried to kill him. Now, they had some sort of local reasons why they tried to do this, but partly they don't like the people that Jesus is implying that he's going to take his mission to. And sometimes the church does that as well. You know, we imagine a certain demographic that we're going to reach, and that's what we try to reach. Sometimes it's the middle class and suburban people and well-to-do people, but sometimes God is calling us to minister to all kinds of different people. You know, people that we might not generally associate with in our own lives. I think of the Mansfelds, missionaries that we support from Montreal. They work with homeless people. They work with street people. And they build a church for street people. Now, you know, when you build a church for street people, you're not going to get on the cover of any magazine. You're not going to become an influential leader in the church in America or anything like that. But you're going to minister to people who have nobody else ministering to them. And so they've chosen to go beyond their prejudices and the natural way that they look at people to see them through God's eyes. And that's what God asks of us. So the question for us today, are we ready? If we have reckoned with who Jesus is, if we understand and call him the Son of God and our Savior and Messiah, and we understand what his mission was, we need to follow, and we need to take that mission as far as he will take it. Because there is no end or no limit to what the kingdom of God is or where it will go. Jesus proclaimed that it would go everywhere, and it will. But he has chosen us, his church, to carry this out and to live it. And so the question for us always, are we ready to embrace this? You can't embrace the person of Jesus without embracing the mission of Jesus. They go hand in hand. Are we ready to do that in the mission in its fullness?